The following program is presented for our audience of blind and print impaired. Your North Carolina Reading Service presents the Indie Week. This issue dated March the 23rd from 2023. I'm John Federson, reading as usual from both the print edition of Indie Week and the online version, which has extra articles in it. It's indieweek.com. And I'll get started almost momentarily. And we'll turn first to IndieWeek.com for an article about a golf course, the old Wake Forest Golf Course and Country Club. Lisa Sorg wrote this, and it begins, "Nature and spray paint are reclaiming the old Wake Forest Golf Course and Country Club. The 160-acre tract off Capitol Boulevard was once a destination for those who wanted to conquer a difficult course, including the first hole, a par 5, that, according to a golf course review website, plays to a whopping 711 yards from the back tees. Now, the clubhouse is boarded up, its mint paint faded by the sun. The swimming pool is empty, serving as a concrete canvas for graffiti artists. Golf cart paths are overgrown and muddy, flanked by noble old trees. Turtles bask on logs in the ponds where beavers have built their dams. The fairways are still mowed, though, and the property has become a de facto park for walkers, joggers, and nature lovers. The latest dispute about the property, and there have been many, involves the Wake Forest investment company, Mill Ridge, which is asking town officials for a special use permit to convert 126 of those 160-plus acre sites for houses and townhomes. The Wake Forest Board of Commissioners is holding a special meeting tonight at 6 p.m. in the town hall. This story dated on the 23rd, so I guess that's tonight. On the town hall at 301 South Brooks Street to discuss the issue and take public comment. But many neighbors are concerned that 40 years' worth of pesticide, herbicide, fungicide, and fertilizer applications could have contaminated the soil. When that dirt is excavated for home building, residents are worried contaminants could enter the air. Last summer, several neighbors collected 3 soil samples and paid for them to be analyzed by an accredited lab. The tests detected arsenic and chromium-6 in several samples. Both these chemicals can naturally occur in soil in North Carolina. However, these same contaminants, known carcinogens, are also found in pesticides. One sample contained levels of arsenic 8 times greater than a state benchmark. This is known as a preliminary residential cleanup goal, but they apply to known contaminated sites that are undergoing remediation, which the golf course is not. In 2 of the 3 samples, concentrations of chromium-6 ranged from 7 to 14 times higher than that goal. Chlordane, a widely used pesticide that was banned by the EPA in 1988, was detected at very low levels. Given the uncertainty about the origin and extent of arsenic and chromium-6 at the former golf course, neighbors asked the NC Department of Environmental Quality to require the developer to conduct its own sampling. Gina Micia, whose home is on the brim of the course, said, "Leave it alone or remove it, but either way, it needs further evaluation." DEQ declined to do so. An agency spokesperson told Policy Watch, because the contaminant levels don't exceed acceptable levels. And, quote, "Additionally, there is no known history of spills or disposal of hazardous substances. Without evidence of contamination, further evaluation by DEQ is not required." But it's unlikely that routine spills of disposal of hazardous substances were reported. That would be especially true when there were fewer or more lenient regulations governing those pollutants. A person with direct knowledge of the operations at the golf course told Policy Watch that there were not large chemical releases, but that contaminants entered the ground from routine maintenance, filling, and rinsing spray tanks, oil, and gasoline leaking from mowers and other equipment. Some pesticides and fungicides in use at that time also contained mercury. At that time, containment and catchment systems were not legally required, nor were there oil disposal services in the early days of the course operation, so workers poured the material on the ground, the person said. An above-ground tank also held diesel fuel and gasoline, and there were minor but regular spills at that site. The person said that the fairways are likely uncontaminated by this time because those chemicals used had short half-lives. But the person said the area near the maintenance bars and the greens should be tested. The samples recently taken by the neighbors were collected near the maintenance barns. As for greens, fungicides were heavily applied to those areas because the golf course owners wanted to grow cool season grass in a hot and humid southern climate. Mary Kircher, who also lives in the neighborhood, says no one is stepping up to let us know if there's a potential issue. We'd love to find out if it's not contaminated, but we need to understand what's in the soil. A bank could require an environmental assessment as a condition of a loan for the property, but otherwise the neighborhood has little recourse. A Phase 1 environmental assessment includes a review of historical records, maps, databases, and interviews with current and previous landowners or others familiar with the property. If there is evidence of contamination or the potential for it, based on the research, a more extensive Phase 2 assessment can be required. That could include sampling of soil, groundwater, and surface water, depending on earlier findings. The original developer, Tall Brothers, told neighbors last year at a public meeting, quote, an environmental impact study is not required and will not be conducted, according to the meeting minutes. It's unclear if the new developer, Jim Adams of Mill Ridge, will undertake a Phase 1 assessment. Adams was out of the office this week and could not be reached by deadline. His attorney for the project, Neil Ghosh of Morningstar Law Group, did not respond to emailed questions from Policy Watch. Golf courses are chemical sinks. They are routinely doused with chemicals to keep the greens looking pristine, while gasoline and motor oil can leak from machinery or tanks onto the ground. Several studies and cleanups of golf courses in the United States have found hot spots, and in some cases, widespread contamination because of these historical uses. In Minnesota, the State Department of Agriculture, quote, became aware of high levels, unquote, of mercury, chromium, and arsenic at tee boxes and greens at golf courses that were being redeveloped for housing. In 2018, the trade publication Builder noted, conducting adequate and timely environmental due diligence is essential. Because these sites tend to have residual soil and groundwater contamination related to the legal use of agrochemicals, such as fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides, over a long period of time. On its website, Partner Engineering and Science, an international environmental counseling firm with offices in Charlotte, advised developers, lenders, and investors, quote, to explore environmental due diligence before jumping into golf course renovation to mitigate liability and financial risk. Other sensitive environmental areas are on the Wake Forest site. In addition to wetlands and ponds, Horse Creek runs through the property and flows into Falls Lake, the headwaters of the Neuse River. Earlier this year, the town of Wake Forest announced it would launch a study of pollution entering the Horse Creek watershed, paid for with $14 million in American Rescue Plan funds. Any disturbance affecting the Horse Creek or the wetlands would require a federal permit from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The dispute over the use of the old course has been simmering for 15 years, has wound through the legal system, and even reached the North Carolina Court of Appeals. In 1984, Joel Young bought the golf course and country club, which at the time was still in business. Seeing the potential to develop part of the land for housing in 1999, Young successfully applied to the town of Wake Forest for a special use permit to sell some of the land as individual lots for two subdivisions, which have since been developed. As part of the special use permit, Young voluntarily agreed to several conditions, including a guarantee that the golf course and its, quote, environmental features remain as open space forever. These restrictions run with the land, not the owner. By 2007, the golf course was no longer economically viable. Young tried to get out from under that previous special use permit and sell to a developer, but he was sued by several neighbors and a homeowners association, who alleged the property had to remain in use as a golf course in perpetuity in accordance with that 1999 agreement. The plaintiffs eventually voluntarily dismissed their case. 2 years later, Young tried again, asking the town of Wake Forest to again modify the special use permit for residential development. The town declined to hear his petition. Young sued in Superior Court and lost, then took the case to the State Court of Appeals, where he lost again. Finally, in 2012, E. Carroll Joyner of Youngsville bought the defunct Wake Forest Country Club and Golf Course for a pittance, about $2,000 an acre, from Young. Toll Brothers had an option to buy the property for development as recently as last year, but the deal fell through. Now Adams, the new developer, wants Wake Forest officials to allow him to remove most of the land from restrictions of that special use permit to build houses. Instead, Adams is proposing to use an existing conservation easement and three adjacent ponds, to meet the open space requirements. But the former golf course that was held as open space, as well as the abandoned clubhouse, pool, and tennis courts, would be developed. Now, here's another article, also from IndyWeek.com, a recreational area that's going to be reused. Peering through the glass doors of Wheels Fun Park's main building, it's hard to imagine that the empty roller rink once teemed with skaters. The ticket stands are bare, save for a box of masks from when the building was used as a COVID vaccination site. Only a funky 80s patterned carpet hints at the vibrant space that once stood within the East Durham community. But the 8-acre property that housed Wheels Fun Park will soon get a new lease on life. The rink could reopen as soon as next spring, said Mary Unterreiner, Public Information and Communications Manager at Durham Parks and Recreation. At City Council work session on February 23, Durham Parks and Rec laid out plans for the site and described a broader vision for expanded recreation facilities in East Durham. The project, Splash and Play, combines renovations to the existing roller rink with visions for an aquatic center, featuring a lap pool, a water slide, and a lazy river. It also includes anticipated improvements to two nearby parks, East End and Long Meadow Parks. The architectural firm DTW, Architects and Planners Limited, has been hired to bring the rink up to building code and ADA standards. That's American Disability Act. Parks and Rec is also selecting an independent contractor to manage day-to-day operations of the facility, to be announced later this month. Wheels Fun closed in 2020 after nearly four decades of operation and was later purchased by the city. Last May, officials unveiled plans for an aquatics center at a proposed cost of $31 million. Keeping the roller rink wasn't part of the original plan, said Unterreiner. That changed after community members made their demands known to the City Council last summer, attending meetings with signs and speakers in hopes of bringing back that skating rink. Durham resident Shanetta Burris spoke to the desperate need for recreational spaces for young people at a February 9th City Council work session, saying, "It's critical that we retain facilities like Wheels and create similar places as well. I hope this council will explore innovative strategies to ensure that money is not a barrier for residents to utilize these spaces." Responding to public interest, Parks and Rec formed a resident steering committee for those interested in preserving the roller rink last fall. They met in October and November to discuss the project and develop criteria for a rink operator. Other community engagement efforts include mail home surveys and pop-up workshops. Some residents have been dissatisfied with communication and outreach efforts, though, raising equity-related concerns about the process during recent City Council meetings. On February 23rd, Durham Parks and Rec Director Wade Walcott reiterated the department's engagement efforts. He also unveiled the concept design for the former Wheels site, which incorporates the roller rink alongside an aquatics park and a community event space. Other components of the original Wheels Fun Park are not part of this plan. Hunter Reiner said, "Some of the existing features like batting cages, go-kart track, didn't float to the top after that process in the way that the roller rink did. We are still flexible and open to work with the community." A third phase of community engagement will be underway soon as officials hammer out the final details of the project. Parks and Rec estimates that construction of the aquatics park will begin in 2025 after a design and construction firm is selected. At a recent work session, council members expressed broad support for Splash and Play. Several emphasized its potential to advance racial equity in Durham by providing recreational outlets to underserved communities. Some, including council members Javiera Caballero and Jillian Johnson, expressed uncertainty about the high price tag. While much of the Splash and Play budget must still be approved, some council members praised the project. Council member Johnson said, "This is a transformative project, and I think it's absolutely worth this kind of investment to get this level of facilities and opportunities for our residents. And I'm committed to figuring out how to make this happen." All right, to the print edition, Charlotte Kremen reports from Durham, absent without reprieve. Anna Bursack, a junior at Durham School of the Arts, was involved in a car accident last semester that kept her in the hospital for 10 days. In October, she caught mononucleosis. Around the same time, a friend passed away. Despite the turbulence, Bursack maintained all A's and B's. As a result, she thought she'd be exempt from finals because of a shift in the Durham County School Board's exams policy the previous year. But in November, she learned that the board had changed the policy again. She'd have to take her exams after all. She said at a school board meeting in January, "You're telling students to not put themselves first. You're forcing unhealthy habits upon students." School of the Arts students say they felt blindsided by the shift and that they received minimal communication before November when they got the news in a school-wide email. The policy adds extra stress to high achievers who get sick or need to miss days for reasons such as college tours and sports, students say. They contend it also encourages students to attend school while ill. School of the Arts students Ella Perrin told the Ninth Street Journal in an interview, "We didn't really have time to intervene, like on the front hand. So going to the board meeting was like hoping they'll get it back on their agenda and rethink it." Under the policy, high school students are exempt from exams if they have an A average in a course and no more than 3 absences for the semester, or 6 for the year. For students with B averages, that number is 2 absences per semester or 4 per year. These totals include both excused and unexcused absences. On September 23rd in 2021, the school board suspended that attendance requirement for exams not mandated by the state, but the board restored the policy in full for this school year. At January's meeting, Chloe Daniel, DSA's student body president, asked the board to change the policy so that only students with 10 unexcused absences are required to take exams. School board member Natalie Bayer said she appreciated the students sharing their experiences at the meeting. Some end-of-course exams are required by state law, she said, but the school board may be able to ease its policy regarding local exams, as it did during the pandemic. Bayer saying, "We want our policies to be supporting students and their mastery of learning and not be punitive. And we certainly don't want students to come to school sick. She said she hopes to continue the conversation about updating the policy with teachers and administrators. Last fall, Janik Stein, a freshman at Riverside High, had the contagious respiratory syncytial virus, which attacks the lungs and breathing passages, he said in an interview with Ninth Street Journal. He also has asthma. He is a straight-A student, but too bedridden to attend school, he says. He still had to take a final exam. Stein's brother Isaac said Riverside High teachers do not consistently enforce the policy, leaving students confused. Isaac said, "If that is the policy, they want people to come to class on time and be consistent with that, it shouldn't mean that's also the case when you're sick." Isaac did not hear the absence policy would return until November or December. That shouldn't be considered good attendance. Parents also worry about that the absence policy's impact on their children's mental and physical health. Kelly Perrin, Ella Perrin's mother and a former school teacher, said she was impressed with how Durham Public Schools managed the school system during the pandemic. Given the health precautions DPS took then, the policy's reinstatement surprised her. Quote, "I certainly understand that we need to incentivize students to come to school and we want them to be in class and learning. But I don't think this particular policy really does that. I've heard of a lot of kids going to school sick, not doing things like taking time for mental health or doctor's appointments." Lauren Forme-Duval is a psychologist in Durham and has two students at DSA. She emailed members of the school board in August, encouraging them to waive the absence policy again. "Students can catch up when they're absent and can still master the material, especially when they have access to computers," she said. Quote, "If a student has an A in the course, then they are understanding the material and they're understanding the contents. How many times they've been absent or present feels like kind of irrelevant, other than it's just a motivator they're trying to use to get kids to come for more often." All right, next to Wake County Jasmine Gallup column about Hayes-Barton homeowners who are suing Raleigh over missing a middle. Six homeowners are suing Raleigh in an effort to get rid of the missing middle housing policies approved by the City Council in 2021 and 2022. Collectively, the policies allow for the construction of ADUs, townhomes and apartments, in historically single-family neighborhoods, as well as incentivize high-density development along major roads. Missing middle, however, has also become a catch-all phrase for the city's new approach to housing and development, which shifted significantly after Marianne Baldwin was elected mayor in 2019. Since then, Baldwin has led the city council in an effort to create more affordable housing by reducing exclusionary zoning, which restricts the kinds of homes that can be built in a neighborhood. Her efforts have sparked protests from some homeowners in wealthy historic districts like Oakwood and Hayes-Barton, who have said missing middle destroys traditional neighborhoods. One of the biggest protests came last year when the city council approved a developer's plan to tear down a historic home in Hayes-Barton and replace it with 17 luxury townhomes, each expected to sell for upwards of $2 million. The missing middle charges meant the developer did not have to request a rezoning and moved forward without a public hearing. Neighboring homeowners held protests outside city council chambers, repeating their usual arguments that the project would lower the value of their homes, reduce the tree canopy, and increase flooding and make traffic unmanageable. The suit alleges that the city council didn't do what they were legally required to do when they approved the missing middle reforms. The homeowners argue that the changes should have been treated as zoning map amendments, which require notices to property owners at neighborhood meetings instead of text changes, which require much less public outreach. If a judge agrees, these missing middle reforms could be declared invalid, and the city would have to restart the process of approving policy changes that have already been in effect for several years. In the lawsuit, homeowners have also named the three companies involved in the townhome project in a seeming effort to bring it to a halt. If missing middle is declared invalid, that could open the door for arguments that the townhome project is also invalid and construction must stop. The homeowners or plaintiffs argue they will be, quote, uniquely and adversely affected and will suffer special damages in the form of increased traffic and parking, increases in the rate and flow of stormwater, and a diminution in the value of plaintiffs' properties. Earlier this year, the City Council held a series of neighborhood meetings in an effort to persuade people of the pros of the missing middle. Staff argued that the policies will boost affordable housing, create more environmentally friendly homes, and bolster public transit. Notably, tensions were high at the meeting held in Five Points, closest to Hayes Barton, which was attended by more than 100 people, mostly protesting missing middle. People in other neighborhoods also raised some concerns. These concerns will be discussed by the City Council during a work session Tuesday. The meeting is the first major discussion of missing middle since the 2022 election, when four new people were elected to the City Council. Some are worried this may make the start of an effort to amend or repeal the missing middle policies. Next, in from IndieWeek.com, an evening-length series of meditations illuminates the music of Philip Glass. I'm reading this now because this is at the Carolina Performing Arts Memorial Hall in Chapel Hill, and it's this Saturday, just 2 days. The Towel of Glass. Byron Woods writes, it's a moment of assessment as a child-sized puppet looks up at creator Phelim McDermott and after a moment reaches out to take his hand. But a surreal, dreamlike quality suffuses the two of them, technically three, including puppet Captain Sarah Wright, who animates the dark-haired youth, as they set out on a brisk walk around an empty, circular stage. As the composer, Philip Glass's arpeggios gently build momentum upward. A second puppeteer lifts the child's feet off the ground, his legs dog-paddling as he gleefully swims through the air. A third puppeteer takes him even higher as he soars above McDermott's head and careens across the stage in a literal flight of fancy. We've seen nothing yet as the sequence unfolds in the Tower of Glass, an evening-length series of meditations on this famous avant-garde composer who wrote 10 new songs for the work. That show will take place on Saturday, March 25th, at Memorial Hall in Chapel Hill. Puppeteers open the doors, panels, and sides of an old black upright piano to release a world within, as music so often does itself. A panel of gossamer fabric, seemingly fashioned from pages of sheet music, unfurls from it. It's a projection surface for shadow puppets that disclose the child's airborne, moonlit journey through a tale of Maurice Sendak, as impressionist layerings of puppetry depict the bespectacled head of Glass himself in passionate engagement with the grand piano. McDermott tells the Indie Week from a studio in London where his revival of the Glass opera Akhenaten just opened last week. Glass's music invites us to see the world in a different way. It can invite you to see a bigger pattern, a deeper pattern in what the world is doing. While the bold cadences in works like his score for the film Koyaanisqatsi have no problem claiming primacy with the listener, the shifting and repetitive structures that form the basis of Glass's composition can also serve as an ambient or meditative function as well. Much of his work does not seek to overwhelm or block out everything else that's happening as we listen. Instead, it often coexists with and can filter, frame, or give a different context to all of the other experiences that are taking place at the same time. McDermott cites the opening movement from Glassworks, which he uses in his show. "It's an extraordinary piece of music," he says. "It echoes moments that you felt in the past, but it always brings you back to yourself in the moment." As he listens on stage, he observes, "I'm amazed that this piece of music can still break me open. It's been doing so for years." After his production of Satyagraha, Glass's epic opera on the life of Mahatma Gandhi, first bowed in 2007, four subsequent revivals of that work have been produced at the English National Opera and the Metropolitan Opera in New York. McDermott's current production of Akhenaten is his third since 2016. The works join a decidedly varied portfolio for the British stage artist, whose West End and New York directing credits have ranged from Shock-Headed Peter and the Addams Family to a musical version of Hayao Miyazaki's My Neighbor Totoro last year. McDermott is slightly hesitant to talk about the connections he finds between Taoism and Glass's music. He says it sounds very heavy and serious, but it's actually a very playful show. The Tao is a playful thing. The religion has roots dating back to the 5th century BCE in China, with precepts recorded in works like the Tao Te Ching. It posits the Tao as a subtle principle that underlies and forms the source, pattern, and substance, the way, of all that exists, often referenced in analogies involving the movement of water. Taoism explores living in harmony with what it finds as the ever-animated, ever-changing natural order of the universe. McDermott says it's like the bubbling of a brook, the sound of leaves rustling. Add Philip's music to those things, and you're getting to a good show. Puppetry and Taoism have something fundamental in common. Indirection is a necessary part of both. According to Taoist scholars, the Tao cannot be said. McDermott notes, you can only point in its direction. Similar to those texts, puppets only reference and point to the people and things they represent. To underscore the point, McDermott and colleagues use newspaper and adhesive tape to make some puppets throughout the show. And he says, the thing about those materials is you can't quite control them. The more you try to make a well-made puppet, the more it falls apart. The resulting state requires what the creator calls a Taoist conversation with the materials. Quote, they're Taoist puppets. If you stay open and you find out what the material wants to do, it animates itself, usually through the mistakes that happen. In every performance, the players make a different puppet of Glass playing at a piano. Every time it's slightly different, says McDermott. If the puppetry is open, it has this sense of a prism or a lens through which a doorway to dreaming can come through. It's a dream door which connects us from consensus reality down to the essence. I have no idea how you explain that to anyone, he laughs. And now to a very, very lengthy article. I confess I will probably not be able to finish this entire article. It's originally published online at a publication called The Assembly, and it concerns the Duke Center for Documentary Studies. That's documentary film, I'm sure. Well, we'll find out. It's at a crossroads as it executive director promises a new era. This was written by Ren Larson and published on February the 28th. And there's an update. Over the course of a five-hour meeting on Thursday, this is back in February, the Center for Documentary Studies director Opiyemi Olukemi and board members informed the attendees that the center was in a financial crisis and was being restructured. Olukemi stated that the center was not an independent 501c3 nonprofit, as she'd been told at her hire, and as it has been operated for the last 34 years. She also said she had tried to resign three times. Attendees at the meeting provided recordings and spoke to the assembly. The center had been draining the quasi-endowment to pay for programs in recent fiscal years, said the board co-chair John Jensen, causing the current budget crisis. Staff learned that under past directors, the board had approved budgets that were not broken down program by program and had received at least one budget that included errors. At least seven center staff learned this week that they are being laid off. Attendees at the meeting also learned two board members had stepped down, bringing the board to nine. In the Thursday meeting, Olukemi outlined a vision for the center going forward that shifts from documentary to, quote, applicable media. While that term wasn't well defined in the presentation, she pointed to examples like working with Duke's academic programs like biomedical research. A follow-up story is coming soon. Now, that I just read is an update, and it doesn't give me the date of the update. It's probably on February 28th. But the story itself? The walls of the Center for Documentary Studies exhibition galleries are bare, with only a few nails, holes, and strokes of mismatched paint to hint at the art that previously hung here. The center's digital presence is just as spare. The webpage for the last exhibit, which was scheduled through May of 2020, still states that it is closed temporarily. Undergraduate students stream in and out of the center's buildings on Duke University campus, and daily business operations have continued, but little of the activity that helped the center earn a national reputation in documentary arts has happened in the last 18 months. The summertime Audio Under the Stars program, now under the auspices of Duke Arts. The Oscar-qualifying full-frame documentary film festival, canceled for the first time since its beginning in 1998. A program that trains teachers to use photography to develop literacy skills in Durham Public Schools, paused. The evening and summer continuing education courses, on hiatus, according to a staff briefing last fall. There have been no new episodes or even teasers for the city's Peabody-nominated podcast Seen on Radio in more than a year. The center did not distribute its most prestigious financial awards in 2022. There are no photography exhibitions planned for the immediate horizon. Students pursuing a certificate are unable to take classes. Application to the center's Hine Fellow Program, which supports early career documentarians, are suspended. Exactly why nearly everything seems to be on an indefinite hiatus has been hard to pin down. The director, Opiyemi Olukemi, who joined full-time in 2021, told staff and board members at a meeting last November that legally and publicly, only the center's continuing ed program is on hiatus. She said the other programs, like literacy, through photography, exhibitions, audio, awards, and publishings, are in a, quote, limbo period. It's not just programs that have disappeared. In the last year and a half, at least nine staff members have voluntarily left. In interviews with the assembly, almost as many current staff said they feel like their heads are on the chopping block after hearing that the center is sunsetting, re-leveling, and restructuring its programs for over a year. Others questioned if they want to continue working there, even if they're not let go, and they blame Olukemi for creating an atmosphere where they are demeaned and demoralized. What was once a staff of 45 is now 24. Staffers say no one has been hired in the last 18 months either, leaving no employees in the adult ed program, no director of operations, business or operations managers. While a board statement shared with staff last fall suggested there are financial problems that, quote, will require changes to practices, procedures, and, sadly, personnel. The source of these problems and why the center can't use its endowments in ways it did previously have not been made clear. The assembly spoke with more than 20 current and former staff members. 11 spoke on the record, while most currently employed requested anonymity for fear it would impact their continued employment, severance, or relationships in the Duke community. Several declined to speak for the same reason. The answer of what is on the horizon is expected to come on March the 2nd, when Olukemi is slated to hold a State of the Union meeting with staff, board, some of Duke's top brass, and representatives from University Human Relations, where they will discuss changes and what comes next. Some staff learned they were being laid off on Tuesday morning. Others have HR meetings scheduled ahead of the larger meeting. Olukemi did not respond to multiple requests for an interview and did not respond to written questions, but sent a brief email on February 17th, stating that the center is amidst a restructure resulting from a comprehensive review and that we look forward to introducing a renewed slate of sustainable programming in the months to come. Statements she has previously made in internal meetings were provided to the assembly by a staff member. None of the current board members would agree to speak for this article. A co-chair directed questions to the university's interim vice president of public affairs and government relations, and that person directed questions to CDS. Multiple employees described the center under Olukemi's leadership as toxic. Another described her management style as authoritarian, top-down, and chaotic. They said she has directed staff and faculty not to speak with board members and that the former board chair had chastised staff for raising concerns about the work stoppage, lack of communication, and the impact of the center's image and reach in a letter to the board last fall. What may have started as an internal matter has started trickling out as documentarians, Durham residents, a funder, and Duke faculty have raised questions about what is happening at a major North Carolina cultural institution that, as of June 2021, had $43.5 million in net assets. The center's 34-year history in Durham has not been without debate over the kinds of questions that plague the documentary genre more broadly. Unlike the field of anthropology and oral history, there is not a standard code of ethics for documentary. At its best, the field has influenced public policies, aided at the release of the wrongfully incarcerated, recorded history, and educated generations. At worst, it's perpetuated harmful stereotypes, exploited hardship, ignored systemic issues, and benefited the people behind the camera more than their subjects. Questions about ethics and who gets to document whose story have long lingered over the center. When Charlie Thompson joined as its education director in 2000, he had been one of its critics. Thompson, a former farmer who had done political organizing with farm workers, has a PhD in anthropology. Part of his directive was to better connect the center with university and professional standards. One of Thompson's early encounters with the center was via its former magazine, Double Take. The coffee table book presentation of people living difficult lives without much context or questioning made him uncomfortable. He planned an ethics discussion shortly after joining, and he said, "How do you, when you're a practitioner of an art, know if your work is ethical or meets standards? You have a film festival, you submit your work there, but how do you know it doesn't cross some boundaries that should not be crossed?" While academics in other fields face peer or institutional board review board critiques, there is not a similar requirement in documentary, said Thompson. The center has never been a perfect place. We have an institution that we're talking about that is not bound by any particular ideology. A group of artists, scholars, and publisher launched the center in 1989 to, quote, support, promote, and further develop the discipline of documentary studies in connection with academic programs at Duke University, unquote, through research, teaching, and dissemination of documentary work, according to the Articles of Incorporation. It was created as a nonprofit, freestanding center within Duke, a model advantageous to its mission, but distinct from an academic department or an institute. While its staff are Duke employees, it can't hire faculty and doesn't offer tenure-track employment. Its board of directors has near-total control of its massive quasi-endowment, a term that means there is not a restriction on how much of the endowment can be spent. Iris Hill, the center's founding director, said, "We had to be independent of the university because we weren't bringing in PhDs. And we might be bringing in people who were making films. They weren't people who would be at the university in those days." The Lyndhurst Foundation, a family philanthropy that historically funded arts and cultural organizations, gave the city center $5 million in seed money. In 1989, Duke agreed to contribute $150,000 a year toward salaries and initial space costs, an amount that would increase with inflation. In recent years, Duke has financially supported undergraduate education costs, including some salary expenses for the undergrad program director and adjunct instructors. In the center's first year, it offered undergraduate courses, hosted exhibits, screened films, conducted oral histories, and announced the Lang Taylor Prize, its marquee award, given to a photographer and writer working together. Its primary output was in print, first books, and, starting in 1995 through Doubletake, a National Magazine Award-winning literary photo magazine. In 1996, Lyndhurst made a $10 million grant to support the magazine. Circulation peaked at $90,000, according to a founder, but the magazine bled millions from the endowment each year. It was amid this first financial crisis that a new director, Tom Rankin, was bought in. Rankin spun the magazine off as its own nonprofit in 1999. It eventually died in 2004. The center launched the documentary festival that would become Full Frame. That's a festival that had been financially self-sustaining through tickets and sponsorship and attracted internationally known filmmakers like Martin Scorsese and Ken Burns in 1998. Under Rankin, the center added its continuing ed courses, a traveling photo and audio exhibition, an audio program, a theater and gallery at Durham's American Tobacco campus, and a visiting scholar program. In 2009, the broader financial crisis also hit the center, and the quasi-endowment fell from about $36 to $24 million. While it had grants from philanthropies like National Endowment for the Humanities, Mellon Foundation, and Pew Charitable Trust, the endowment's investment earnings had funded an average 65% of the center's work over the prior decade. Rankin said he secured a low-interest line of credit from Duke, up to $4 million, according to a proposal at the time to allow work to continue and avoid layoffs. According to the most recent IRS disclosure, investment income funded roughly $2 million of the center's $4.6 million in expenses in 2021. At the same time, the center was facing more pressure to diversify its staff and educators. Fellowships brought many scholars of color to teach at the center, but without the ability to secure faculty appointments and a low staff turnover, full-time employees remained largely white. Rankin stepped down in 2013 to direct the university's Master of Fine Arts program in experimental and documentary arts, and Wesley Hogan took the helm. During her tenure, She instituted a 3-year pilot to increase paid opportunities for early career artists who are typically underrepresented in the field. Continued support for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee Legacy Project, and began anti-racist training for staff. Full Frame also launched a series of panel discussions in 2016 called Docs So White, confronting issues like who controls access for people trying to break into the industry, lack of mentorship, and questions about who can tell whose story. While academics in other fields face peer or institutional review board critiques, there's not a similar requirement in documentary, said Thompson. In the first annual Docs So White panel, Roger Ross Williams, an award-winning director, producer, writer, and first African-American director to win an Academy Award, spoke about how decision-makers only come to him if they have a black story to tell. Another filmmaker, Sabrina Schmidt-Gordon, called on funders to question and challenge the privilege of filmmakers. Natalie Brown, a North Carolina State University professor who helped spearhead the Documentary Accountability Working Group launched in 2020, said, "These questions of privilege, benefit, and harm have prompted a larger industry-wide reflection. We're trying to get people to be thoughtful of the potential harm and ways that they can use values-based filmmaking to collectively not harm." So it was amid this backdrop that the center began its search for a new director in spring of 2021. It was the year after Breonna Taylor and George Floyd were murdered by police, when the COVID pandemic was disproportionately killing people of color, and when corporations, nonprofits, and media were affirming a commitment to addressing systemic inequality. Olukemi had addressed the need to fund stories from people who have not been able to tell their stories in her previous position, leading POV Spark, the interactive arm of a storied documentary series that airs on PBS. That included helping launch an African artist residency and the Instagram documentary series Otherly, which, quote, amplifies perspectives from a group of underexposed creators, namely women, non-binary, and genderqueer identifying folks. The October 2021 of her announcement of her hire said she was drawn to the center for its transformative power at a crucial moment in history. She said in that announcement, "The Center for Documentary Studies is uniquely positioned to lead, and not just in nonfiction media creation, but in determining the power of documentary and its impact on our culture, and in critiquing, challenging, and altering the systemic forces that bind us." Michelle Seymour joined the center as its business manager in October 2020 to handle duties like payroll, expenses, and budget. It was similar to work she'd done in other offices on campus over a decade of working at Duke. But within a month of the new executive director starting, Seymour says she was told by Olukemi the board wanted her fired. Requests to multiple board members to confirm this were unanswered. Seymour said she immediately began looking for jobs. She said the feedback she received from Olukemi was highly critical, and that she was asked to monitor fundraising, which was not part of the job she'd been hired to do. She said in an interview, "I've never been treated like this before. This was unreal. Belittled. I was made to feel like I didn't know what I was doing." Seymour felt like she was made to question her every decision, and said Olukemi told her she could not directly reach out to other staff to ask questions about their expenses, something she felt was sabotaging her ability to do her job. "I still have PTSD when it comes to certain things," said Seymour, who left in August of 22 and took a job managing contracts and grants at Duke School of Medicine. "I'm still feeling the effects of a job of working under her." Michael Betts II, who was the director of the center's continuing studies program, also left last August. Betts was one of two black program directors at the center and served on the faculty staff hiring committee for the new executive director in the spring of 2021. Olukemi had stood out in the candidate pool, he said, quote, when she was given an opportunity to ask questions, she asked staff how we were doing. Everybody else had wanted to talk about the board and talk about big visions. He took Olukemi's interest in the staff's well-being as characteristic of a servant leader. Betts said he felt like a breath of fresh air had blown through the center when Olukemi introduced herself to staff at an October 2021 meeting and spoke about equity. But a comment from that work meeting stayed with him. After Olukemi spoke about growing up in Africa and working in anti-black spaces, a colleague asked her how they could support Olukemi. You can't, he recalled her saying. Betts said he didn't know what to do with that answer. If we're going to do this thing together, we have to all go together. Betts said, just because you're the leader doesn't mean you need to fall on somebody's sword. He'd supported her hire, and she was his favorite candidate of the pool of three. Betts said, in this moment, I admit fully that I was wrong. He said he thinks his fellow staff members who served on the committee, all of whom still currently work, would agree. Another staff member who was on the hiring committee agreed with the statement. Betts said his perspective of the new executive director soured over time. While other programs ramped down in the pandemic's early month, CDS Continuing Studies program had offered online classes for nearly two decades and rose to meet the demands of students stuck at home. Its adult education courses in photography, video, audio, writing, creative media, ethics, and theory were in full swing, despite losing one of its three employees, a program coordinator, in August of 2021. Betts, who interacted with as many as 1,000 students a year and had a newborn at the time, was exhausted. Well, I am three or four pages shy of completing this long, long article about the documentary program at Duke University. You can go to indieweek.com and find the article in its entirety, which lets you go back and forth and reread sections if it's of interest. But this is a major arts and cultural program at Duke that's been severely damaged from some various combination of reasons. Well, John Federson now has to say so long for Indie Week, and will return next week with the next weekly issue. In the meantime, this issue, should you decide to hear any more of it, is available there on ncreadingservice.org. Thanks for listening, and so long.